Good morning. It's March 20th, 2007. We're here in room 464 of the state capitol. My name is Dusty Johnson. With me are Commissioners Gary Hansen and Steve Kolbeck. We're here for the purpose of hearing a hearing in TC06-190, and that deals with e-church and some concerns about the do not violations, do not call. At this time, no, not do not call, sorry, dealing with e-church. Cramming, sure, that's right. And at this time, we will turn it over to staff and hear their comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is Kara Van Bakken for staff, and I'm going to start by right away passing out. I've got three folders here that will contain all of the consumer bills and a spreadsheet, various information that we're going to rely on today. So I'm going to pass that out. I'm going to rely on the facts as stated in the motion for the most part. However, I'm going to run down a quick list of what happened and who's who in this docket. So the simple version is as follows. Lars Person is the owner and incorporator of Radical Person Incorporated, a California corporation. That corporation did business as both eChurch and iLab, and they were registered as fictitious names in Orange County, California. We had 10 specific consumer complaints regarding one or both of those companies, and all 10 of those complaints were substantiated by our Consumer Affairs Division, and all of those various consumers should be included in your packet. All 10 of those people were billed, people or businesses, individuals or businesses, were billed for a 1 minute, $50 long distance phone call. And due to the high number of complaints, Consumer Affairs began an immediate investigation of these companies that appeared to be involved. As the investigation began, Radical Person Inc. supplied our Consumer Affairs Division with some information, and the spreadsheet that you'll find right away in the beginning of your packet is a spreadsheet that they did supply our Consumer Affairs Department, and that included a list of everyone they claimed that got billed. However, as Consumer Affairs went down the list and tried to call these people and contact them, it appeared that a lot of the names were wrong, phone numbers are wrong, and I'm going to rely on Ms. Gregg to expand upon that at the conclusion of my outline here. In any event, many of those people were billed for a $50 internet charge, not something that we have jurisdiction over nor something we could help them with. We therefore passed all of those on to the Attorney General's office. Some of them did not wish to dig up their old bills or couldn't dig up old bills to find that $50 charge because we needed further information to help them. They didn't want to bother. And others, like I said, it was simply the wrong name. We couldn't get a hold of them. So in the end, we were able to substantiate 10 consumer complaints. Originally, Mr. Person and his lawyer articulated several defenses to the allegations, and we therefore proceeded with a motion for an order to show cause and scheduled this hearing today. Since that time, Mr. Person and his lawyer have indicated they had no intention to appear today, and they're in the process of filing for bankruptcy. We've had several communications with Mr. Cisneros, the lawyer for the corporation, and he's indicated on several occasions he was going to get us a copy of their bankruptcy papers. We've yet to get it, so I can't expand upon the progress of their bankruptcy proceedings. However, SDCL 493189 prevents this company from adding a product or service on a consumer bill without permission from the consumer. So we're relying on that statute for this motion and request today. That did clearly occur. The bills will show that there was a $50 one-minute long-distance phone charge. SDCL 493193 does indicate that the subscriber is not liable and the company shall pay to the subscriber a $1,000 fine. Ms. Gregg's been in contact with all of the consumers that were affected by this. They all understand the status of this company. They understand the likelihood or lack thereof of collecting a monetary fine due to their progress in this bank in the bankruptcy court. And again, I'm going to let her expand further upon those communications with those consumers. But as we know it, as we understand, the 10 consumers affected did not pay that $50 fine. They called us first, which was perfect. So they are not out, should we say, the $50 that they were charged, and understand the status of the company as far as the $1,000 fine. 49 SDCL 4931-94 allows the commission to fine up to $20,000 in a penalty when this sort of thing occurs. Due to the status of the company and its apparent progress towards bankruptcy, staff is at this time asking for a $10,000 per penalty violation to be suspended based on the condition that Mr. Person seek permission or at least put this commission on notice if he ever intends to do business in the telecommunications industry in South Dakota. And I'll rely on Deb for any further factual questions you may have.
Can I ask one question right now?
Mm-hmm.
$10,000 per or $1,000 per equaling $10,000?
$10,000 per consumer, $10,000 times 10 official complaints that we had in this office. All of it suspended unless he would come back to South Dakota and fail to put the commission on notice.
I guess I was thinking that the maximum fine was $1,000 per.
I'm sorry, I should clarify that. It's $1,000 that goes directly to the consumer. There's two different fines at issue here. The first statutory, the $1,000 is under SDCL 4931-93, and that's $1,000 that goes directly to the consumer. It's not something we can collect on behalf of the consumer. They need to proceed individually, and none of them chose to do so due to the status of this company, and we have tried to keep them all informed along the way as what we know of each church and where we're at with our proceeding. And all of them decided that it wasn't worth their time or energy to come to South Dakota at a formal hearing proceeding, and they really want to see the commission stop this sort of behavior and prevent this company from coming back to South Dakota simply under a different name and reincorporating somewhere else and coming back. So all of those consumers are really on board with the recommendation that we're making at this time. The other fine, the $20,000 per violation fine, is something that the commission directly collects, and that's SDCL 4931-94. And once a company goes into bankruptcy, we won't be able to seek the monetary fine due to the bankruptcy stay. However, a non-monetary fine could be, we could proceed on that due to our police powers. And I've had help from commission counsel in studying the stay from bankruptcy and all that goes along with it. And this monetary, non-monetary fine or condition that he come back before the commission to seek permission or at least put you on notice, I believe we could enforce because it would be considered a police power.
So we don't have, we don't know for certain that this company is filing for bankruptcy or that they, and even if that's a certainty right now, they could certainly change their mind.
It is. We spoke, Ms. Gregg and I spoke with Mr. Cisneros last Friday, I believe it was, and he said, I can guarantee we will not be at the hearing, and I can guarantee we're filing for bankruptcy. And I don't know what that's worth, but those are his guarantees.
And he is an attorney in what state?
California.
Okay. You know, I have some, and it's probably just, well, I have some reservations about suspending a fine for a company that has not been particularly cooperative, has not shown up today, has not provided any paperwork promised with regard to their bankruptcy proceeding. There's evidence to suggest that they were attempting to, you know, defraud consumers. Why do you think that suspension makes sense in this case?
That recommendation was based solely on Mr. Cisneros' guarantee that they will be filing for bankruptcy and that it will be very difficult and costly for the commission to pursue that fine. However, we certainly could, and it was based solely on just the, his guarantee they're filing for bankruptcy.
And so, and perhaps, and I don't mean to suggest that John Smith has a lot of experience with bankruptcy, but I think he might have some. I mean, either Ms. Van Bakkeren or Mr. Smith, can you try to give me some idea of what costs the commission might incur if we tried to, you know, fine and carry this through the bankruptcy proceeding?
Maybe. The part of the problem here is not just that it's a potential bankruptcy. I mean, in my view, it's even possible that a fine might survive a bankruptcy. That's my own opinion. In fact, I succeeded in convincing the judge here in Pierre that in the S&S fine case that was relieved from the discharge order automatically. Now, the stay is a little different situation. It's tough to get relief from a stay. It costs money. I mean, we'd have to hire a lawyer in California and go out there and fiddle around with it. The other difficulty you get into when you're dealing with a situation like this is, even if the fine ultimately were not subject to the bankruptcy court's discharge order or the stay even, the practical difficulty of it is we can enter the order here, we can go down here to the circuit court, we can have it entered as a judgment. But ultimately, to obtain enforcement, that means initiating litigation in California to enforce it. There's nothing here in South Dakota that they don't have anything here. There's no property, nothing of that nature. So it would mean having to go to California and obtain execution on a fellow out there. And I think the thought behind something like a suspension is, and you can think about it any way you want to, but sometimes having a hammer hanging over your head is more of an incentive than having already been hit by the hammer. Then it's over with. And my point is, I'm not so sure that I wouldn't want that suspension to be conditioned on more than just them giving us notice. I'm not so sure I would not want it conditioned on there being no further similar type of activities occur, period, as well as them notifying us and coming in here. And then I think it gets down to this. I think the message it sends is whether you decide to go with a $10,000 fine or $100,000 and it's suspended, to me it would be a pretty strong motivator to say, maybe in order to avoid triggering that, I should cease doing things like this. But that's kind of up to you. I mean, I will tell you, it'll be a pain in the neck to attempt to obtain a judgment and execute on it in the state of California, regardless of the bankruptcy. But under that context, we'll have the additional issues of litigating a lot of things. I would tell you, too, and this is just based on some checking I think I did early on, and I think Ms. Van Bakkeren could maybe fill you in on this. One of the things that I think's happened here is this fellow and his outfit, we're not the only state that's taken this guy on. He's been hammered in by the state of Wisconsin. My recollection is something along the order of $4 million in judgments are outstanding against him there, and it gets down to what do you want? I think it gets down to resources, and do you want to, for something that may or may not do any good, do you want to subject the staff to what will be a very labor-intensive and ultimately out-of-pocket cost endeavor?
Yeah, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm glad you asked the questions that you did. I was curious about them as well. A couple of questions. First is, who prepared the sheet of information that we have the spreadsheet, I will call it.
Sorry to interrupt. Do we need to enter exhibits or offer exhibits?
You sure could. Should we mark it and call? How many? Why don't we just mark the whole packet of stuff? And why don't we do that? We'll call it Exhibit 1. And do you want to move its admission?
Okay, I move that commissioners admit Exhibit 1.
And that's the entire folder full of information. We don't have a reporter here anyway, so I think we'll just do that. And
I would presume that there are no objections. I mean, there are no other parties to the proceeding here.
Keith, do you object? then I'm going to recommend that it be admitted. And I think in the other side of that, though, is since nobody showed up, I mean, this is a default situation. You know, you have a default situation here where they didn't bother to show up or answer or do anything else. And, I don't think you need any proof or anything. I think you can operate on the basis of default.
Still good to have a record available.
That's correct.
Okay. Apologies. So we'll say Exhibit 1 has been entered into the record, and my apologies to Commissioner Hansen for interruption.
No, Mr. Chairman, I appreciate your doing that. In Exhibit 1, there's a spreadsheet and three pages. I'm curious who prepared that.
Commissioner Hansen, this is Deb Gregg from staff. The spreadsheet that you're looking at is what was received from Lars Person or Radical Person, Inc., when we asked them to produce us with the number of consumers that they billed in South Dakota. When we first contacted them, and this is the sheet that they sent us, the information they sent us. And Ms. Van Bakkert and I are the ones that called down the list and tried to find the companies, and this is the list they provided us of who they billed. And as Ms. Van Bakkert said, some of the names weren't the same. Phone numbers were disconnected. And the notes on the side that are typed in are theirs. Ours are handwritten on the front and the back of trying to locate the companies. In fact, the one for the Fargo realtors that have the Comfort Inn in Sioux Falls, we found them. They were just getting ready to pay the bill, and they pulled it from being paid. So that was one that we tracked down. Another gentleman on the back, the Spencer Hawley Insurance, that was actually an internet charge, and he had paid for 2 years. And I sent him to the Attorney General's office to try to recoup those charges. He didn't even realize he was paying another $50 a month for an internet service. He had no clue. Some people, as Ms. Van Bakker said, didn't even want to go look for the bills that we contacted. But this is a spreadsheet they provided to us.
In this spreadsheet, then you said that everything that's typed on here is from them, and everything that's written is from the PUC, South Dakota PUC. Okay. And so they did, in a form at least, excuse me, reply to our contact with them.
That's correct. That's about the only correspondence we received from them.
This is pretty much the entirety of their correspondence?
That's correct.
Were you able to engage them in any phone conversations other than discussion with apparently their attorney and finding out that they were at least claiming to
try to work
bankruptcy?
Well, not through the bankruptcy. We actually, and how confusing this company is, we actually had it's supposed to be their assistant, Christine Chu, contact our office for names and numbers of the businesses that we found that she didn't have. And they tried to offer settlement, giving prepaid phone cards to people, said they'd be sending something. And it never happened. Karen and I happened to be one step ahead of them every step of the way, calling people and telling people, you're going to be called by this gentleman. This is what he's supposedly going to offer you. Get something in writing. Anyone who was contacted contacted us back saying thank you for the heads up. And we believe that this list that they had is just something, I don't know if they made up on the fly or what. Like I said, nothing was consistent with what we found.
Is there any legitimacy in the prepaid phone card that they were offering, or was it to their service?
We have no idea. No one received one.
Okay. Through the first presentation and the discussion of this, I agree with Chairman Johnson that I'm not comfortable with just simply saying, shouldn't do that, we're going to fine you $100,000, but we're not really going to fine you $100,000. Mm-hmm. We're going to just don't ever do it again. It's a sort of a, if I get caught, nothing's going to happen to me. If I do get caught, nothing's going to happen to me. And that's just concerns me a little bit. The, more than a little bit. The, there's just no way that a person accidentally charges $50 for phone calls. And if there's no attempt, they're not here today to discuss it, not even by phone. It just shows that there's not a genuine effort on their part to work with us or to work for themselves in trying to let us know what took place. And it appears, at least, Mr. Chairman, that there may have been some effort by them, although that effort also appears to have been a little bit on a perhaps a smokescreen to try to make it look like they were at least attempting to do something. I can't, unless there's, it's hard to figure out just exactly what they were doing here, other than from your testimony, Deb, it sounds like they were preparing information and trying to find out what we knew in an attempt to perhaps thwart our effort, or was it to make it look like they were at least taking care of those people that we knew about?
Their initial, defense when we contacted them was that there was a computer hacker that got into their system, and these bills were sent in error, and to ignore them, Ms. Van Bockeren asked several times, give us the name of your computer guy. Let us talk to him. Let's figure this out. And then why didn't you call us if you knew that there was a computer hacker? Why didn't you call and warn? There are two people you really needed to contact, our offices in South Dakota. If it was true that you had a computer hacker, you know, and this was taking place, the Attorney General's office and our office, why didn't you just make these two simple phone calls, give us a heads up? He didn't have an answer. And he just kept saying it was a computer hacker, so never could provide us with that information.
Did they come up with any names, such as on this list or otherwise, that you did not, that we did not already have, that the PUC was not already working on?
Most of the people, no. I mean, we sent out the press release, which did not have anybody else step forward, really, that we hadn't contacted or that they hadn't contacted. Most people that got a bill contacted our office, because a 50-minute phone call kind of was a red flag to them.
What I'm curious about is, did they volunteer the names of any persons who we did not already have contact with?
No.
Okay. That almost appears that they were attempting to, I won't try to ascertain what they were trying to do. Just on the face of what took place, it's pretty obvious that they knew what they were doing, and they knew what they were doing was wrong. So, Mr. Chairman, Counsel Smith, if you could help me out a little bit, is there something of that sort, I like your analogy of the hammer hanging over their head as opposed to hitting them on the head, is there a method by which we could still have that hammer over their head so that if they ever were to pursue these types of activities again, we would then be able to use that hammer rather than just go through a suspension process? Or do we have to then, if we fine them $40,000 or $100,000, do we then at that juncture have to pursue?
No, we would not have to necessarily pursue the statute of limitations for a fine is 2 years. So within 2 years, we would have to initiate a case in civil court to collect on the fine, or it would become unenforceable after that point.
So if we made any effort at that juncture, do we have to at least start the process in court, or can we renew the 2 years or a 1 year if by sending letters or things of that nature?
No, I don't think so. I think we have the 2 year. If you levy a fine today, at that point in time, that becomes your action on this. And in my own opinion, you would have to take action in the circuit court within 2 years.
And if we started in within that two-year time frame, is there another statute of limitations, or do we just go through the process at that juncture?
At that point, yeah, the process would be going into court. You know, there's always a potential argument you face concerning discharge with bankruptcy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, again, I've been through that, and in the S&S case, of course, they didn't show up either. They defaulted, so mm-hmm. it's not like you're
right.
thoroughly airing the case or whatever. But the judge did buy the fact that this was subject to one of the exemptions from discharge.
And that is very likely what would take place here. However, at least we would have some type of hammer as opposed to...
Right.
Mr. Chairman, I'm just feeling the same discomfort you are, just simply saying, don't do it again. And if you do it again, then and we catch you again, then we might do something. I just I struggle with that.
It's tough to give a... I'm sorry, were you done?
No, go right ahead.
What is the penalty for doing business as a telecommunications provider in this state without a certificate of authority?
This is Kara Van Bakken for staff. I believe that is STCL 493175 and Class 1 misdemeanor. And then I believe there's, help me out. Mr. Smith, there's a $1,000.
That one might be, I think that particular statute might be just for local exchange certificate. I think the one for the other one's in Section 3, if it's inter-exchange, which this guy, his kind of activities would be. I think there's, though, where you come up against, too, is what he's doing here, it's possible he didn't provide any telecommunication service, you know. I mean, he didn't, his...
You get into a lot of trouble for charging and not providing, then you do...
He just billed. Well, and I think, you know, it... Normally, I mean, with somebody operating here without a COA, I mean, you know, usually what's always happened is just running them in and making them get one. I was going to look at Section 3.
I'm just trying to, it seems to me that if the reason I'm uncomfortable with suspension is that it seems as though that is what we want our hammer over their head to be in case they come to South Dakota and do this again. I just sort of feel like if they come and do it again, and maybe, you know, lack of COA isn't the issue, and maybe it would be another cramming, you know, docket, but it seems to me that if they come and do it again, then they have to pay the price. I mean, if you whack somebody with a hammer once for what they did, they're unlikely to do it a second time because they know you're going to whack them with a hammer. That's the deterrent mechanism, not the fact. I mean, frankly, if you hold the hammer over their head, they do it once and you don't hit them. Aren't they just that much more likely to think maybe the second time you also wouldn't hit them?
Certainly possible. Again, I think one of the other issues, and it just gets down to the commissioners. I'm not going to argue you shouldn't impose a fine today. I'm not. I will tell you there will be significant real-world practical difficulties in taking that to the point of actual money.
Well, and I'm sorry to interrupt, Mr. Smith. And I don't think any of us want to squander, you know, the public's resources. I mean, you know, if we get involved in some costly California, you know, litigation. And I suspect they don't bill out at $50 an hour in California. I understand that's not, I mean, eChurch isn't paying that. I mean, that's going to come from, you know, ratepayers, you know. But it's tough for me to balance that when I don't know how much we're talking. I mean, does anybody even have a rough ballpark for me? Like, it would cost $15,000, you know, to to do what we want to do in California court? Anybody? I don't.
I mean, usually the thing that's tough about something like this is, I mean, where you get into work and spending money is, first of all, if we were going to deal with the bankruptcy situation, that's expense and work. But besides that, I mean, the execution is the next thing. And what's costly there is tracking down of assets, finding somebody's assets, and then taking action to foreclose, you know, to execute and foreclose on assets is, it's a pain in the neck, you know, and it's a very localized type of work. You have to know how things work there. There are firms out there that do that kind of thing. You know, there's Mark Tobias, whom you might have met in your life. That's what he does for a living. That's what his business is looking for assets for the Citibanks and the, you know, the Daytons, or what do they call it now, the Retailers Bank and that kind of thing. And, you know, and we could, you know, I'm not arguing it either way. I'm just saying there will be practical difficulties in imposing a fine on a fellow that's in California. I don't have an exact number, and it could vary dramatically.
Thanks, Mr. Schmitz. I have another question, but Commissioner Hanson, you were in the queue before I was, and Commissioner Colbeck, you were in the queue as well.
I guess my question is just a little bit different. According to the brief that was filed on November 15th of 06, Ms. Van Beckman, you referred to eChurch claims to have three active customers in South Dakota. Could you elaborate? Has that been found to be not true, or because that would be obviously a blatant disregard for the COA authority? Have you found those three active customers?
We have, and those involve the. We did find three. It was the Wenzel Insurance Agency.
Oh, okay.
Spencer Holloway Insurance and Fritz Chevrolet. They were currently paying on those bills, and they since have ceased paying. And
this is Deb Gregg from staff. Those were for internet services that we found under iLab, so they were all referred to the Attorney General's office to try to get that money back that they've paid.
And I think there was some, this is Kara Van Bakken for staff, there was initially when the motion was filed, our facts were confusing, and I apologize for that, and there's some discrepancy probably between what we filed in that initial motion and what we came to find out after we obtained enough information. We simply needed to file that brief with the facts we had to move forward on the motion to get the information we needed. So since that time, we have found the 10 consumers that, in fact, were billed for telephone services. And they never received any service. So they didn't receive any telecommunication service of any type, but they were billed for it.
Thank you.
I appreciate that. That's somewhat part of the question that I had for you, Ms. Van Bakken or Ms. Gregg, if you could explain to me, do we have, or does this individual rather have any history with us, with the state, of similar challenges or problems that you're aware of?
Nothing that we're aware of, okay. No.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead.
I just have one more question. Has this individual ever tried to get in to the state of South Dakota? Has he ever been denied? Is this something that he's tried to do, come back later? I couldn't get my COA, so I'm just going to do it this way type of a deal.
Not that we're aware of. And it appears from the research we've done that he intended to be an internet supplier, and he intended to supply internet services. And then kind of worked his way into the phone service and found that as an avenue as well. So I think originally his company was internet.
I understand the challenges that would come with, you know, trying to get some execution in California. I wonder, would it be possible to put together some multi-state coalition? I mean, if a number of states are attempting to, you know, whack this company and these people, and if they would have to go through a similar process, you know, is that it, would there be any legal complications to that?
These guys can probably address that better than me. Yes, there are. Those do happen. They call them multi-states, and they do that. We've got another case pending where I know there is one of those in progress involving one of the other companies whose name I won't name. And yes, that happens. It wasn't totally clear, and from what I did, just doing a little digging around on my own, I couldn't really tell whether they were targeting certain areas or whether this was a ubiquitous nationwide kind of a thing. The state that's been, I know, really active and has levied very large penalties against them is Wisconsin. And maybe you guys can explain a little more about that.
This is Kara Van Bockeren. It appears that most states' attorney general's offices are those that have sought the large fines and that are currently proceeding against them. And we did contact our attorney general's office, and they didn't have anything pending in their office. And it didn't appear, and this was back in October, that they intended to pursue anything against this company. That doesn't mean things haven't changed in their office, and I have not communicated with them recently. In Iowa, in 2003, the department, the utilities board, did levy a civil fine, and that's is no longer pending. It happened back in 2003. So that's the only utilities board or utilities commission that I'm aware of that's proceeded against, and the rest have all been attorney general's offices.
And certainly we could be part of a multi-state coalition with attorney general's offices as well.
You know, I don't know how that works. I apologize.
Okay. And I guess I probably shouldn't have prefaced my question with the certainly. But it seems to me, you know, a single attorney might be able to be hired in California to handle a number of these different claims. Ms. Van Bockeren, if the commission were to levy a fine today and not suspend it, and if down the road you, Ms. Gregg, and others were to determine that it would be too costly to pursue that, would you be able to bring forth a motion to suspend the fine at that time?
Procedurally, is that I would think that would be appropriate, and that would be great, and I would certainly love to investigate with attorney general's offices from Wisconsin, South Dakota, wherever it might be, to see if we could cooperate with them in some way and make it a joint effort. And I would think procedurally, Mr. Smith would
I mean, I think you could. Yeah, I think it's pending. It's just a commission order until we take it into the court and get a judgment. And we can always do that, too. We can go get a judgment here in South Dakota. Then it's a judgment. It's got a 20-year statute of limitations once it becomes a judgment.
I, you know, will echo the comments of Commissioner Hansen a little bit. I mean, it just seems to me that if we suspend the fine, I don't know that we're sending the right message. I don't know that it would be in the long-term public interest. It just seems like it's so easy to defraud people, and it's tough to get caught. And then once you do get caught, you know, maybe it's not that difficult to evade actually having to, you know, pay the fines that were assessed against you. Bankruptcy is a tough thing, and I know that it may be difficult for us to work through that process, but I am very reticent to suspend the fines. I also am somewhat curious as to why staff has decided to recommend a $10,000 fine per incident as opposed to something higher. I'm not necessarily interested in getting blood out of a turnip, but it seems like when people are systematically working to defraud consumers, you know, we should probably have, you know, some outrage at that. There was a reason 10 was a better number than 20?
Ms. Gregg would say, she jumped up and down when I said 10. She really wanted the whole 20. I just looked at the statute, and it said prior offenses, size of the business charged, compliance history. He hasn't been before the commission before. This is the first time, as we know it, he's been in South Dakota. Not that that excuses his behavior in any way, shape, or form. I was just erring on the side of being conservative. I think definitely he knew what he was doing and he did it, and he made money off South Dakota residents. So.
The attorneys are always reading the statutes and attempting to be reasonable.
I would say another thing, though, too, if I might, just on context, I mean, you know, if you were to levy a fine that large, I mean, $100,000, that's a huge fine. You know, you don't ever see that in the court system here. You know, it just doesn't happen. You know, you see jail time and other things, and maybe that's, you know, you offset that. Well, a few days in jail's worth a hell of a lot of money. You know, I mean, that's a big, big, big fine.
Yes, I just have one question. If we were to, as you say, hang the hammer over their head, and then he does violate, is that something that would be prosecuted in South Dakota then, or would we still have to go to California to prosecute him?
Well, he would be in violation of a commission order if he came back to South Dakota. So we would get a judgment against him here in South Dakota, and then collecting that judgment would still be difficult.
So we wouldn't be any money ahead if we, either way. If he came back and violated, or if we went after him.
Well, at some point, too, I mean, I think if you began to see this, if you saw this happen again, at some point you have to look at this and say it's criminal conduct. That it's actual larceny. Here, I don't think the AG's office probably didn't feel they had enough to show that and to drag him in here. And, you know, getting extradition on something like this is hard, you know. But I think if you saw something like, if this happened again with this same guy, at some point you have enough of a pattern to where I think you look at this. If this is what we think it might be at worst, I mean, there's a word for that. That's called stealing, you know, and you go to jail for that.
I was more after if we suspend the fine and then he violates, do we prosecute him in South Dakota? Mm-hmm. But if we impose the fine, we know we have to go to California.
And I guess from my perspective, the main goal, I guess, with the suspension would be that he never come back to South Dakota again. And that might not be as effective as actually finding him now, as Mr. Chairman articulated. Mm-hmm. If you violate our rules, you're going to be punished now, and you will the next time, too. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's more of a deter him from coming back than the suspension.
I'm good.
You know, I understand, Ms. Van Bakker, when you mentioned, you know, that what the statute lays out for different criteria you can use to determine, you know, what an appropriate penalty is. This kind of business model, I think, is among the most insidious. I mean, you pick an amount of money big enough to where you can make a lot of cash, but small enough that hopefully some businesses will ignore it for months or years at a time. You prey upon, you know, small businesses that can't afford to have a large accounting staff to catch these things. It just seems like it's tailor-made to rip people off. And could it have been worse? I mean, yeah, I suppose they could have, you know, milked a few more people for, you know, $50 a shot. But I think it's pretty bad. You mentioned that the statute also talks about prior conduct. I mean, this is a company that, you know, in 2003, the Iowa Utilities Board was taking action against. And then they wait a little while, and they decide they're going to pop over to another prairie state and see if they can make a couple $50 shots over here. And, you know, General Counsel Smith is right, $100,000 is a lot of money. Just doesn't seem like it's anywhere near enough. And so I hope they don't ever do this again, and I hope we'll be able to, without spending too much ratepayer money, be able to actually get some satisfaction of being able to have these guys pay for what they've done. And with that, I would move that the commission fine $15,000 per incident at 10 incidences for $150,000. Hearing no second,
I'll second it.
Perhaps I was not draconian enough for my colleagues. There was a lot of hesitation.
I'll only make a comment, and I'm not in any way intending to reflect upon my esteemed colleagues' judicial abilities here. I'm just thinking that I was thinking perhaps $5,000. And recognizing that it's already passed, $100,000 is a lot of money. What he did was certainly wrong, and I'm just trying to weigh it within the respects of the degree of criminality, and it's always difficult, and it's always $50,000 is a heck of a lot of money to me. $100,000 is I would probably be willing to spend a couple months in jail rather than pay $100,000. But I will with those words of that I think we've hit him in the head with the hammer, and we're holding the hammer above his head. I will actually concur with the statement, just with the motion, but with the statement that I think we've leveled a pretty healthy fine. And perhaps the message here is anyone who does this in the future, perhaps it's even a stronger message from that respect that probably best that you stay in Iowa and don't come to South Dakota.
This is probably as good a time to bring it up as any. I mean, I think you had some persuasive comments, Commissioner Hansen. I wonder if we shouldn't change our standard operating procedure, not to motion second and concur, but to have someone make a motion and then be able to discuss that without a second. So that, you know, we're able, I mean, in typical parliamentary procedure, you can't debate a motion until it's been seconded. Well, from a practical standpoint, with a three-member board, it's passed at that point. Right. So perhaps make a motion, and then after discussion, we can take a quick roll call vote. And somebody could make a motion for discussion purposes that they wouldn't even end up supporting, you know, 3 minutes later. If that is okay with you guys on a go-forward basis, we could make that our standard operating procedure.
Yeah, well, I agree, because as Mr. Hansen said, Commissioner Hansen, wanted to go a little bit less, and I guess my opinion on that would be, well, if you're going to go to California and sue the guy, you might as well make it worth your while. So that would be, that is the type of dialogue that would be nice before a motion and a second, I guess. So I would agree with you, Commissioner Hansen, or Commissioner Johnson, and Commissioner Hansen. I agree with
you. I very much appreciate that comment. Commissioner Colbeck and I were both to an extent born and bred in that avenue, and Commissioner Colbeck having just come from the local government, and I came from local government just prior to this, and very accustomed to having a motion made, having the opportunity to discuss it, and that's one of the challenges here. Certainly the three of us don't want to go off and violate any of the laws of South Dakota by sitting down and discussing the issues away from the table here. And so it gives us that opportunity, I think, to at least have that discussion when a motion's made. I very much appreciate that suggestion. I think it would be a welcome change here.
Well, and from a parliamentary procedure standpoint, I mean, a second is generally required to make sure that a motion is not you know, ridiculous or unnecessary, and the three of us would never make such a motion. So a second would be unnecessary to begin with. But all right, then. Is there any? I would like to thank. It is evident that this is was a tremendous amount of work and calling and following up, both with eChurch and with Mr. Person and with the folks that were charged that $50. So certainly our appreciation to staff for all of their hard work. Is there any other business to come before the commission? Hearing none, we'll stand adjourned.